Blog Talk Radio.
To end the review behind the scenes, guys. This is your Maverick Moment segment, and my name is Michelle Conwell Jordan, and I'm your host. Tonight, I am very excited. Oh, gosh, I'm losing my voice. I'm very excited tonight that I'm having the opportunity to chat with author, playwright David Lamb. He is here as part of his Right Now Literary Virtual Book Tour. David, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm glad to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, good. I'm very glad. I'm very excited to chat with you. Just to hear all the things that you've worked on. I've been reading a little about you, in your bio, and I'm excited to chat with you. Well, we're going to jump right into it after a brief little message, and then we'll go from there. Sounds good?
Sounds fantastic.
Hi, this is Cecile Monique, and you're listening to Indie Review Behind the Scenes, your source for the hottest in indietainment's news and features.
Again, thank you so much for joining us tonight, joining me tonight. I'm so used to having my co-host, David. Could you please tell a little bit about yourself for those that are listening?
My name's David Lamb, and I'm an author and a playwright and a theater producer. I grew up in New York City in Astoria projects and public housing, and eventually I went on to law school at NYU because people told me I should do something concrete with my life. And I knew that wasn't what I really wanted to do. I always wanted to be a writer since the sixth grade, but still I did that. And while I was working as a lawyer, I wrote and self-published a book entitled Do Platanos Go with Collard Greens, about relations between blacks and Latinos. And it's a romantic comedy. And I would go and speak at colleges, and the students would tell me, oh, this would make a great play. And I said, yeah, that sounds good, but it's too much work. And later on, I had the good fortune of marrying somebody not only better looking, but smarter than me. And she said, you know what? That sounds like fun. And we said, okay, we're going to go in and do this for one weekend. And she bought a book on producing an off-Broadway show, and I hired my law school roommate as a director, and we planned on doing it for one weekend, June 27th, 2003. And the audience came out and fell in love with it, and it just kept going and going. And we still tour colleges to this day, and we ran off-Broadway for more than 12 years.
Oh, my goodness. That is incredible.
Hi, this is Cecile Monique.
I do want to hear a little bit more I love tech issues, don't you? I do want to hear a little bit more about that as well, just the whole process, because as you said, that is a very complex, you know, situation. I think writing novels, you know, is more of the writer and his computer or her computer or paper or whatever, but you're dealing with multiple people, personalities, venues, and all of that, so we definitely want to get into that. But let's just go back a little bit. You mentioned that you had the love of writing when you were in sixth grade. What kept you, even though they were telling you you needed to go to law school, what kept you writing, you know, in the face of all of that? And I know law school had to be extremely, I would think, grueling. So how did you fit your writing into that schedule and into your life?
Well, I should back up and say, when I was a teenager, one of the most popular black reporters on the radio at the time, his mm-hmm. name was David Lampel, which sounds a lot like David Lamb.
It does.
And he sort of looked like me. And so whenever he would come on the radio, I would substitute my name and pretend I was him.
Wow.
And that gave me a goal to aspire to. I wanted to be a journalist, and I went to high school for that. So that was always there. And then when I went to law school, you know, I'm studying things related to contracts and big deals. But, you know, I'm a young black guy who grew up in the age of hip-hop at that time. And listening to Rakim be the greatest poet of the 20th century and not be recognized for it, mm-hmm. I was inspired to write, you know, and I would write critiques of the music and sort of the Flotsam and Jetsam was like one of the first hip-hop fiction books. And so I did it simultaneously. I would go to work on Wall Street in a suit and then come home and transform into a different identity to become a writer. And it's like the guy wrote Rich Dad, Poor Dad said,
right,
keep your job, work your business. And that's
like
what
that.
I did for a long time until the business took over my life.
Well, we're going to chat about your newest release, but then I do want to go back to your playwriting. On Top of the World, Until the Bell Chimes. Where did that idea originate? And how long did it take for you to complete this book? I mean, you know, from conception to release.
You know, I think it's been germinating in the back of my mind for a very long time. When I was growing up, I loved to read a lot. And I would read, you know, Mark Twain or Charles Dickens or Shakespeare, in addition to black authors like Langston Hughes and Ralph Ellison. But when I would read Shakespeare or Mark Twain or Dickens, I would always ask myself, what would they be like if this were represented as part of our story? You know, and I would imagine reimagining them. And it just so happens that in the recent era, that is one of the hottest forms of literature, or Broadway. You know, Wicked is the hottest show of Broadway, and it's a reimagining of Oz. And the genesis of On Top of the World really hit me during the Occupy Wall Street protests. And these people who were protesting Wall Street, the symbol of the 1% for them became Jay-Z. And I'm looking at this saying, how did this guy from Marcy Projects become the symbol of the 1%? And I start asking myself, well, if Ebenezer Scrooge were alive today, what would he look like? And my answer was, he'd be young, black, and handsome with musical ability coming out the wazoo.
Wow.
And so instead of being a crusty old English man in my story, he's music's biggest star. And he's young, black, and handsome, and irresistible, but greedy as ever. And my writing, you know, I like to make people laugh. That's what I like. And I write romantic comedies that are also about race and class and history. So you're laughing throughout. One of the things I loved about the play is that people would come up afterwards and say, I didn't know I could learn so much and laugh so hard. And that's what I try and do. And so it's a romantic comedy on top of the world about a woman who falls in love with Scrooge in college. At the time, he's the biggest nerd on campus. He has glasses as big as an owl's eyes, and he has no cool whatsoever, but she sees something in him. And through her love, she helps him discover his talent, only to realize too late she created a chart-topping monster with an ego the size of Texas. And it takes off from there.
Nice. Oh, my goodness. So now, this book, and so how long did it take you to complete it?
Okay. I'm going to say 4 years. Really, from 4 years, because initially since I was reimagining it, I was trying to be true to it, and I was writing it in third person, even though I thought it should be first person. And eventually I won that battle with myself and made it first person. And once it became first person, you know, the humor just leapt off the pages. I just had my first reading on Saturday at a library in the Bronx in New York, and people were literally falling out of their seats laughing, you know. And so I felt good about that, and I was happy because all of my editors are women, and when they said that I had nailed the female's voice, the heroine's voice, Belle, because the story is written, it goes back and forth between her voice and Scrooge's voice, that really made me feel good, you know, to be able to capture that. And then I submitted it for the Pacific Book Award for Best Fiction, and it was selected as 2016's Best Fiction, so that made me feel like, you know, I was on to something.
Congratulations. Wow, very cool. Congratulations. Who are some of the authors, I think you may have mentioned a couple, but that influenced you know, as a reader, because many writers are readers as well, you know, that influenced you in your writing?
Oh, for sure. Well, I mean, I mentioned Ralph Ellison, and right. I remember being in high school and my teacher saying it was going to be too complex for me, but I was like, what? No, I can handle it. and
like
just in even though it wasn't a reimagination of the Invisible Man per se, he still incorporated that in the beginning of it, people's inability to actually see him for who he was. And so in a sense, you know, that planted the bug for reimagining these stories in an African-American context for me. So certainly him. In contemporary times, like I said, I like to laugh, but also I have politics in it. And Charles Johnson's Middle Passage, you know, there's a story set in the slave era, but in many ways it's a romantic comedy. But yet it's dead serious dealing with the issues of slavery. You know, and I like Kimberly Lawson Roby's stuff because of her. It's smooth reading, you know, and Terry McMillan's ability to touch your heart. I try to incorporate all of those elements from both sides, from the politics, from the comedy, and from the romance.
I think that is awesome. And that, you know, to me, and I love romantic comedies and, you know, and movies and or reading, but I feel like that they may be one of the toughest genres to write, you know, because, you know, just it's so subjective, you know, oh, you know, I'm writing this. Will this get the message across? Will they laugh? You know, will they, you know, like this, or will this touch their hearts? Do you find it difficult to write the romance and, you know, in the stories coming, you know, from a male point of view, or no?
Like I said, all of my editors are women, and my first reader, the editor, is my wife.
There you go. So
and she, you know, she stays on me to make sure it's not too masculine, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I've gotten more of a handle on it now, but I still got to lean on her. And I make sure that, you know, 90% of the people who read it in advance are women. You know?
Right.
So that it's not too masculine. I mean, it's still, you know, it's going to have that because I am who I am. But I recognize that I have to find that within myself and without myself to capture that and to make it romantic, And I could tell you, when we first did the play, we were new to it, and we forgot to save seats for ourselves. So opening night is sold out, and my wife and I can't see the show.
Oh, no.
We had to stand outside the door and listen, and we're waiting for the first laugh, and like 30 seconds in, the audience laughs. And then a minute later, they start laughing again. And then they keep laughing, and they're dying laughing. So we knew it was funny, and then the romantic scenes came, and you could hear them react to that. So I knew I had the ability to do that in a play, but then translating that to a novel, I really had to work hard at it. But it's very romantic. One of the reviews, the Hollywood Book Review, gave it 5 stars, and they said perfectly combines humor and romance and a satire about race, class, and celebrity worship. So that, that made me feel like, okay, people get it.
Got this. That's very cool. And let's chat a little about the play. You were saying that at first it was a book. And many people said, oh, it could be a play. And so it's okay. And so you did it. What were the steps for that? I mean, how do you jump from a book to having a play that, it's ongoing, such a hit. What were some of the processes for that you went through, getting the studio, getting the cast? How did it all happen?
You have to be deranged.
Okay. Yes. I think a little bit, right?
Yeah, a little bit.
Just a little bit. You're going to have to be crazy to even try that, right? But
yes, you have to be an eternal optimist, yet a pessimist. And I went into it believing that it could be done. If you believe something can be done, that's the first thought. And we haven't, going to law school, I had some knowledge of business, and we did it from scratch. We went around to New York City looking for a place to rent that would make sense, and we rented a theater. We held casting auditions, which were comical in and of themselves. and we could not find the lead male for a really long time. We were way into rehearsal, and we just couldn't. It was very difficult to just find a person who could just appear as a regular black dude going to college. It was very difficult to find, because at the time, I also just wanted to do movies, and they wouldn't even come audition. So that took a long time. But in rehearsal, we would be dying laughing, so we knew we had something funny. But one of the things that's very similar to fiction and books is you could have a great story, but now how do you get people to hear about it?
Definitely.
Had to figure out how to get the word out. Luckily, since it had been a book before, it had a name, and so we were able to capitalize on that. But it really, I had to learn to manage people. And that was such a challenging process that I went back to some of my old bosses and apologized to them for anybody.
You're like, I'm sorry, now I understand.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. And how big was the cast? How big was it?
Eight people.
Eight different personalities. That's very, very cool. And so you guys, and then you said that you were into the theater. So I thought you mentioned colleges. Did it travel how did that work?
Yeah. Well, we ran it off Broadway, and at the same time, we would go and travel to colleges. Since I had spoken at so many colleges, they they wanted to see the play. And from then until now, it's probably going to 300 colleges and universities across the country.
That's incredible. So it literally is still going?
Yeah.
The play. That is incredible. Congratulations. That is awesome. Do you ever think that – oh, go, I'm sorry.
Yeah, so the goal is do the same thing with On Top of the World.
And I was just going to ask you that. I was going to ask, do you see that happening with On Top of the World?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I just saw Birth of a Nation today.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of the things that stuck with me, that stunned me, was that even though it was set in slavery, there was so much love between the black men and the black women in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
There was so much, and I sat there saying, wow, I've never seen us depicted as just loving each other.
Yep.
You know? And On Top of the World, you know, it will inspire you to believe in the power of love. Because in this story, Scrooge is not no old dude. Like I said, he's music's biggest star. And he got there because a woman turned his life around, and then he started acting a fool. And so when the ghosts come to him, he realizes he's got to get himself together and make a change to win back the woman he never should have lost by acting a fool. So it's, you know, it's very much about the power of love. And that's something we...
And this is for, you know, college and up. It's for adults. It's not a specific age group.
Yeah.
For did you find it difficult making the transition from writing the novel to the play, or, you know, play to the novel, however you want to do it? Do you find it difficult making that transition? Do you lean more towards one versus the other? I mean, you're proficient and you're awesome in both, but do you have a preference as far as the type of writing?
There's different thrills from each.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's different thrills from each. With the novel, it's you said, you know, because writers are also readers, and
I'm
you know, you're a reader of your own books too, and so when you write a novel and you're reading it and going through the draft, the characters eventually become real to you, you know, and you could imagine, like, well, he wouldn't say that, she wouldn't say that, and you can picture them in your mind, and that's, you know, that's a thrill. But when you're a playwright and you get to sit in the back of the audience and see the audience's reaction to your work, that's intoxicating, you know.
Yeah.
And so to some extent that would help me write about this character, because I had to ask myself, okay, if I didn't have my wife keeping my ego in check, and I just thought deep in and thought I was the God's gift to everything, what would I be like? And that's how I was able to write this guy whose music's biggest superstar, and his ego is completely out of control. So much so that he's suing the federal government he spent $5 million suing the federal government to have his face placed on Mount Rushmore.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. That's incredible. But she turns him around. Now, that is cool. I would love to see how she did that, you know, someone that far.
Yeah.
You got to kind of love him, though. That's confidence. I like that. How fun. Where do you get these ideas? Where do they come from?
I like to laugh, you know. I mean, I'm into history a lot, but I like to laugh. And so what I try to do is combine my love of laughter and my love of history and say, you know, how can I take something that's a serious topic and make it mad funny and very romantic? So, for example, you know, back to the idea of Scrooge. Today, everybody raves about Charles Dickens, and he's much beloved, and you got Dickens museums and Dickens this and Dickens that. But the truth is that in America, in the era of slavery, the Southerners hated Dickens. Because Dickens
really?
Dickens came to America and did a traveling tour and wrote about his experiences, and he wrote about the cruelty of slavery in the South, and he became an opponent of slavery, and he was one of the people who got Britain to adopt to further their Abolitionist Act in 1843. And so they disliked him greatly in the South. And so I took that real history and made it part of the character's story. And the reason he's named Scrooge is because his great-great-great-grandfather was on the plantation of Virginia's cruelest overseer. And to get back at Dickens for writing this, he decided to name his next slave on his plantation after Dickens' favorite character, Ebenezer Scrooge. Only he made it backwards, Scrooge Ebenezer, because he said niggers get everything A backwards. And you know what A is.
Yeah. Wow. Wow, that is incredible. Well, I tell you, you sound like you've had fun, you know, with writing it. And I think that a reader can tell if the author is just, you know, we have there's much discussion on writers just writing towards a trend or whatnot. But you seem to truly enjoy and believe in what you're writing, and I think that will translate to the reader. Now, you brought up a great point. We were chatting about your play, but it is this way about the books. Getting the word out, no matter who's published by whom, that seems to be a major challenge, whether, you know. So how are you getting the word out? We know, you know, I know that you're on the tour, but what are other ways? Do you do conventions? I mean, what do you do?
I believe in the power of marketing. And we are going to have advertisements actually on New York City buses.
Wow!
I believe that, you know, I've built up some fan base, knock on wood, in New York, so I'm going to start with New York, and you know, expand from there. But you'll be seeing, you know, you'll be seeing it on Facebook every time you go on, to the point that you're sick of it, but you're going to love it because once you read the book, you're going to be like, oh, thank God he was advertising it. I bought this. It's fantastic. And you're going to see it in e-blast and in newspapers. But I'm going to start with New York just like I did with the first book, with Duplass and Oscar with Collard Greens, and then eventually, you know, it caught on nationwide. So, you have to pick your spots and your strategy, because money talks, and by that I mean newspapers only look at certain books, and the reality is they're going to look at the publishing companies who have the money to spend advertising with them. You know, that's just, you know, that's just the way it is. And so you got to look at getting in where you fit in. You have to target who it is that you think are going to be fans of this, and go after them to begin with. Not go after everybody, but go after who you think are going to be fans of this to begin with, and start there. And so that's my approach.
Very cool.
Also,
please, you're great.
Okay.
You're ready.
Also, you know, a book can appeal to people in different ways. You know, this book is probably going to appeal, hopefully, to fans of Charles Dickens, will appeal to African-Americans who like history, people who like romance, whether they're African-American or not, people who like to laugh, and people who like political satire, you know. So you have to be thinking about that. And it's kind of weird because on the one hand you're an artist, but on the other hand you got to think about the business, you know.
Right.
And not let one detract from the other.
And that's not always easy to do. And I think for a lot of writers, you know, many writers that may not have that background, they come in thinking, okay, I'm just going to write my book, and, you know, I don't know, by osmosis, you know, it would gain its audience. But you're absolutely right. You really have to have that mindset of focus and, you know, that savvy as far as determining your audience, you know, right from the beginning. What would you say would be one of the major things you've learned since you started writing either your play, you know, all the way to now, the major, you know, major things you've learned through this entire writing process and publishing process?
Okay. That not to hold your ideas in your head till you think you had it perfectly crafted and can write it in one take without having to make any revisions. By doing that, you stop yourself, and you're editing yourself unnecessarily. Get the ideas down on paper. Get the ideas down on paper, then go back and look at it. But don't hold it in your head, because they're going to vanish and be gone. You got to get it out of your head and get it down on paper. And another thing I learned towards the end of On Top of the World, but it hasn't stuck, is if you can edit on the computer, your writing life will be so much easier.
But
on the new piece I'm working on, I was editing it by hand, and it's just sitting there. I got to find the time to do it. But if I had just done it on the computer, it's harder, you know, because for me, the ideas come easier, at least initially on writing. But eventually, after a while, after you've read it enough, then you can get to the computer, and it's easier.
Very cool. I agree with you. Oh, my goodness. You know, I have so much respect for people that write, you know, these novels, the manuscripts, long can, but that is tough. goodness. Oh, goodness. It came out of my mind what I was going to ask you next. But so what? It did. It just kind of flew out. So what do you do when you have a spare moment, you know, your downtime, your relaxed time? What do you do? What are some hobbies?
I get harassed by my daughter. that's a big hobby. I am presently and have been for a while, but I abandoned it because I wasn't making progress studying the trumpet. Originally, I studied it for egotistical reasons, not because I wanted to learn, but just because I wanted to be able to hold it and look cool like Miles Davis. but lately, I've been making a tiny bit of progress. The thing is, my daughter, when kids have no fear of stuff, and about 5 years ago, I was practicing and making no progress, and she was 3-4 years old, and she just couldn't take it anymore. She came, snatched the trumpet from me, and said, "Here, let me show you." And she played Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star.
Wow.
Just like that. Now, a trumpet is hard to blow. So me, being a maniac father, immediately I ran outside, took her to the music store, and bought her a red flugelhorn. Because I'm like, you're a genius. You know, you got talent. We got to push that. 3 days later, she's no longer interested in the trumpet. I'm like, you're killing me here. You know, I mean, I like to read. I like to study all religions. And see the connection. I'm trying to get back into exercise. I used to fake do a martial art till I injured myself. So I'm trying to recover so I can do that. But those are the things, you know. And writing consumes, like, no matter what I'm doing, a story is going through my head.
Yeah.
And an idea for a story comes, and I write down and say, I'm going to get to that one day.
So how do you, you know, I'm curious, how do you identify yourself? Are you, a script writer? I mean, I've got you in the movies. Playwright, a novelist. Will you maybe move on to movies? And what's next? What is another project you're working on?
Well, I'm going to turn On Top of the World into a play, and I have another classic story, I can't tell you what, that I'm reimagining. So it'll be turned into a novel, then a play. Those are my goals. I've been approached by a couple of times by people in Hollywood per se, but the deals have always been so bad, it's unbelievable. The last one I took to my lawyer, and he laughed out loud and said, "Well, it's not the worst deal in history. It's just the second worst." So if I can get something that's not the second worst deal in history, then I'll do that. Yeah. But in the meantime, I'll write and turn them into plays and hopefully be able to have long-running plays that people come to and laugh and feel inspired by.
I know that you said that your wife is very supportive. But in general, how is your family? Do they support you in your success? Because you're very successful in your writing. Are they surprised? What do they think about your writing, your family overall?
Well, I was blessed and cursed. I'll say mostly blessed to have the most encouraging mother in the history of mankind, perhaps. I always say if I had been a serial killer and ended up on the news, my mother would say, I knew that boy was going to amount to something.
He's the best. Oh, well, that's sweet. It's very sweet.
Yeah. So, my mother's been very supportive. When I was in, and I forgot about this until late last year, when I was in the seventh grade, my mother enrolled me in a playwriting class that took place on Saturday afternoons at Hunter College, and I would go to Hunter and learn about playwriting, and I totally forgot about that, she didn't have a lot of money, but she wanted to encourage me. She's always been extremely encouraging, to the point that I had to ban her and my grandmother from coming to my book readings when I first started writing. Because if anybody said it wasn't the greatest thing since sliced bread, even if it was the second greatest, she and my grandmother would flip. So I was like, y'all are banned. You can't come.
Find a breakout. Oh, my goodness. That's funny. Oh, my goodness. Well, I don't want to forget.
You said about am I doing any conventions or anything. This Saturday and Sunday, I am going to be at the Circle of Sisters event, which is an event in New York sponsored by WBLS Radio. It's like one of the biggest conventions. And it's going to be at the Javits Center on Saturday, October 15th, and Sunday, October 16th. And I'm going to be there along with my lovely wife, Jamila, signing copies of the book and meeting and greeting people. So if you're going to be at Circle of Sisters, I'd love you to come by and check us out.
Very cool. So, guys, you hear that? If you are in the area, make sure you stop and show some love. Well, David, I enjoyed chatting with you, and yes, you are very funny. And definitely will need to check out On Top of the World. And do you ever videotape your plays, or are those only in person, right now?
They're only in person. But you can, if you go online to YouTube and you punch in Platanos and Collard Greens, there's an EPK, it's called Electronic Press Kit, where you can see people talking about it and you can see scenes from the play and see why people love it so much. Yeah.
All right, there's also
two trailers for On Top of the World on there. And if you want more information about me, you can visit davidlambbooks.com. And that's David and then Lamb, like Mary Had a Little Lamb, and then books, books.com. Or on Twitter, at author David Lamb, either way.
Awesome. Well, there you go. Well, guys, make sure you do go out and you make that connection with David and check out On Top of the World Until the Bell Chimes. And, make that connection and follow and show some love. David, thank you again for being here. I do hope that you will come back and just keep us in a loop, hopefully you can chat with myself and my co-host and you can tell us and keep us in a loop of what's happening. So thanks so much.
Definitely. Thank you. And thank you for having me.
You're welcome, and thanks so much to Paulette Harper. Thank you over there at Right Now Literary Virtual Book Tours. We just love Paulette, and we thank you for connecting in the review behind the scenes with author David Lamb. All right, guys, that is it. Thank you so much for hanging out with us for a little bit, and we hope that you all have a wonderful evening. Why? Because you deserve it. Have a good one, guys. Bye-bye. Good night, David. Thank you so much again.
Good night. Thank you.